Hi, and welcome to another edition of Amana Podcast. This is our 15th podcast. Amana is a collective of people, places, things, and actions that transcend us. It's living through our higher virtues and how you lead your life with your higher virtues, what takes you off course, and how do you get back on in real time. And today it gives me a great pleasure to introduce a very close family friend, Colin Warren. Say g'day, Col.
G'day, guys. Love to have this opportunity, Mark.
Yeah, no, thank you for doing this. So Colin has, I will give some background here. Colin has been a great family friend of my family since I was, around 14, maybe 14, 15 years of age. And so we've had great journeys together, not just in Australia, but in the United States and in Europe. And he's traveled a lot with my mother around the world. So he knows me only too well. And beyond that, Colin has been in his career a great financier, and I would consider someone that truly cares about people in that industry. And when I left university, I was around 34, I think. I moved back to Australia, and you really mentored me in understanding the financial worlds and financial markets and how that played out, and how to, at the end of the day, how do you take care of yourself financially? And you did that for a lot of people and shepherd a lot of people in your career. So let's kick off with saying, with your career and some of your background, Col, around what you've cared about in your career and probably state. You're a financial advisor and where you started and what that journey was like and what took you on that path.
Yeah, it's very interesting, Mark, the path of life. First thing you've stimulated a thought was my mother. She used to say to me when I was little, "You've been a really lucky boy, Colin, you know, and you've got to look after people. That's your responsibility, you know." I reckon Mum was telling me that from about 12 years of age. Well, and yet the funny part, I was living, you know, on the coast just south of Sydney at Wollongong. And when I was 11, they sent me to a country school because I had very bad asthma and I was having great breathing difficulties. So they thought the country air would, I'd be able to breathe better and I might live a bit longer. So they sent me to a country school. And agriculture was a compulsory subject at the school. This is when I was 11 years of age.
Yeah, wow.
Now, we didn't have a farm. My dad was an accountant, wasn't he? And I said, "Dad, we haven't got a farm. Do I have to do this?" He said, "Look, give it a year." Anyway, a year went by and he says, "Well, do you want to go back to school or do you want to stay at home now?" "Oh, yeah, I want to go back with my mate's dad." "So you'll have to do agriculture." "Doesn't matter." I started then going to my friends' farms. I became so interested in agriculture, Mark. I ended up with a first class honours in the subject, and I thought, "Oh, I'll study agriculture." And Dad said, "Son, you get asthma and hay fever, the land will kill you. Do commerce." "Dad, I don't want to be an accountant like you." Anyway, he gets me a cadetship with a major insurance company in Australia, right? And I start studying commerce, accountancy and economics mainly. And at the end of that first year, Dad said, "Well, what do you want to do? Do you want to go off and do your rural science or what?" "I think I'm a natural at this commerce thing, Dad. I love it." He couldn't believe it, right? But it was probably mainly economics that I really enjoyed. And then the insurance company was the biggest insurance company in Australia at the time. I then became involved with basically the investment management practice. And then I got involved with their agents that were selling insurance. And because I'd studied insurance law, the agents at times used to invite me out to meet with their clients to talk about some of the problems. And again, that opportunity to start talking to people from a young age, like I was probably about 20 years of age or 21 years of age when this started, and learning about the problems that faced business people in particular, And anyway, when I was 23, I resigned from the company and started my own practice, business consulting and investment management services. And at 23, Dad said, "You're too young. Nobody taking any notice of your son." "Well, it doesn't matter if you fail, Dad, when I'm young. I can always go back and be an accountant like you, can't I?" But I think on that point, I've never been frightened to try something new. If I felt something wasn't right, I couldn't do it. So I'd experiment. And I think, you know, many times been saying, "Why are you doing that? That won't work." I said, "I don't know. Let's try." And the number of times that just through experimenting, you learn from each step. You know, you come a problem, you then solve the problem. Mm-hmm. And it's just amazing. It's being not frightened to try something new, to question what you're doing, right?
Yes.
And again, when I started the business, I used to run seminars each month on basically the principles of investment management. And people liked my philosophy and people started being referred to me. But then what I discovered, a lot of accountants, they don't like giving business advice.
Mm.
They'll tell their clients, you know, how much money they've made or they've lost. And so a lot of companies were being advised were going into liquidation. And anyway, I sent a note around to the accountants and said, "Look, guys, if you've got clients that look like they're going broke, if they want some help or some advice, send them to me. Let's see if we can help them." And I had a big whiteboard in the office. And so all of a sudden I'm starting to get these companies making appointments to see me.
Yes.
And invariably you work through their problems and you could identify if we could solve that part of it, you don't have to go into liquidation. Well, 60% of the companies that have been advised to go to liquidation, we saved. They didn't have to go. But the interesting part, we never charged a dollar for this service, Mark.
Amazing.
My staff used to say to me, "But we're not charging these people, Colin." And I said, "Look, we're doing pretty well as it is. If we don't help them, who will help them?"
Mm.
And but the irony of it, are those companies that we saved, and over my career, it was over 200 companies, Mark.
Incredible.
And 2 or 3 years after they've continued operating, they're trading profitably, aren't they? The next thing, they're knocking on a door saying, "Oh, we've got some money, Cole. What should we do with it?" Well, in the end, all these companies, because the government introduced our superannuation system 30 years ago, roughly. And so we started up a system basically managing all these directors' superannuation funds. And then all their employees, they wanted to be in it, right? And so our financial planning, our business consultant and business, the investment management side of our practice just continued to grow and grow and grow. And it was interesting. Had I not been prepared to try and help these people, these business people, I don't think that investment division of our practice would have had the success that it ultimately just continued to grow and grow and grow, right?
You think that came naturally to you to give that away and just help people because that's what your mother told you to do? Or is that something that you were told and kind of thought, no, that would be a good business investment?
Well, it's interesting that, see, in life, I've always felt that we all need mentors, but we haven't. You know, most people, their mum and dad, like my dad, I always spoke to him what I was doing and invariably give me his views, but say, "It's your call though, son."
Mm.
And I think in life, you know, it's not an easy path. And we all need help. But I think for the majority of people, we're not getting the level of assistance and help, the mentoring that would help us massively in life, Mark.
Yeah.
And I think the tragedy, the accounting profession, they've all had commercial training. But I think it's a fear that it's all about money, I think. "Oh, these people have got no money. They're going broke. I don't want to spend, you know, 5 or 10 hours. I'm not going to be paid." And so consequently, you know, instead of thinking positively, if I can save this client, this company, they're a client, they'll continue to be a client for life.
Yes.
It's a little bit short. It's a fear of doing something and not being paid. And it's a major problem in our society throughout the world. It's all about money.
Yes. Well, certainly if I was to, talk about my experience with you in your financial firm, and I say this humbly, it's like you have truly what I deemed as a shepherd for really the average person, if you will, someone who hasn't spent a lot of time chasing money, if you will. They've been in humble professions, either in the agricultural world and farming, which is a very challenging space. You know, you're spending all your time getting up early and managing the land and if you have livestock and things like that, it's just bloody hard work, right? Now, they don't have time to go figure out the financial markets, and I found that you were really there for them thick and thin. If it was personal issues, you know, the minister to the psychologist to the financial advisor, you've really been there for people. And what do you think drove you to those places to help people in such a way?
It's interesting, Mark. It's something to do with our character, I think, right? Money has never been my God, and yet my business was 10 times more successful than I ever imagined, right?
Yeah.
The secret of life is to pursue happiness. And you measure your success with your happiness, in my view. Not how big your bank balance is. A lot of people are rich, but they're not happy. What's the point of it, right?
Yeah.
And I think probably I blame my mother, I think, Mark, right? Mum was a Sunday school teacher. Mm-hmm. My dad never went to church, right? And when I was at the boarding school that I went to, of course, we had church 13 times a week, didn't we? But when I was in my final year at school, I said to my minister, "Do you mind if I don't come to church anymore, sir? I feel you've taught me enough about the Bible and about Christianity, but I feel there are other things now I'd prefer to be studying." He said, okay, Colin. Now, I was vice captain of the school. I wasn't school captain, I was vice captain. And I had my own little study. Anyway, the headmaster heard that I wasn't going to church anymore. He came and knocked on my door when I was doing some study and said, "Colin, you're meant to be at church. So don't you think I've had enough lessons? There are other things I think are more important now." Okay, I'll accept your word then and let me go, right? Now, when I told Mum what I'd done, she said, "You can't do that. You must keep going to church." And I said, "Mum, I don't know if you figured it out yet, but heaven's here. It's nowhere else. It's not up in heaven. It's here, that Mum. Colin." Colin. But what we learned was that Jesus cared for people, right?
Yeah.
And if we don't care for each other, then life becomes basically a drag, a fight. You know, look how we've evolved. And people forget. I remember a conversation I had with you 20 or 30 years ago to remind you that you're an animal, remember?
Yeah. Well, it was this, you know, so I've been obviously on my spiritual journey, and you had been in your career and beyond your career, but very much in the financial markets. And here I was coming to you saying, "Cole, you know, heaven's available right here and now, you know, and be present and all this kind of rat bag stuff." And you're saying, "Mark, you have no idea. We're just part of the animal kingdom." You know, and I said, "We're not animals. We're a different species and all this." Well, I must say, either you brainwashed me or I've had enough experience in the financial markets where I've gone, "It's the bloody animal kingdom." It really is. And you know, I think you said it earlier, which is really true. I think if you make money your God, it really is a fight of the righteous. And and might is right and all that kind of stuff, and the toughest will win, and it's very much the old law of Moses, you know, it's eye for an eye, it's all that kind of stuff, and it very much is the animal kingdom, it's survival. But you know, yeah. And you know, as I like to start out, what Amana is about is transcending certain things, you know, like as an athlete could transcend a sport, like an Arthur Ashe or a Billie Jean King. You know, I really feel like you transcended your swimming pool, if you will, in the financial markets, where you really did transcend and help people get into their moral compass. Because you, I remember you would counsel people and say, well, what do you want? You never even started with money. Just what do you want and what are you doing to go about it and how can I help you? You know, and I think that's what really built your practice, is that you were, people really felt your caring and concern, but also your wisdom and know-how of how to navigate these markets. And, you know, let's just say it, a lot of the mongrels that are out there, you know, the wolves.
Well, it's interesting, again, how we've evolved. You know, before the Industrial Revolution, we were basically all farmers, weren't we?
Mm.
And it was all about making food. And at the end of the day, food and water and air, without those ingredients, we die, don't we?
We're not here.
And the interesting thing, though, of course, is that once we moved into the Industrial Revolution, we moved off the land, and then science, medicine. My God, 300 years ago, the average life expectancy was 16 years. Not 60 years, 16. Now, mortality was very high among children. But again, the evolution of medicine and basically how we overcame our disease problems and we started living longer. And
I'm going to pause you there for a minute. And you may be going here anyways, but could you explain to our listeners your philosophy on the ABC of life and the philosophy you created around the A life, B life, C life? And I think this stems into what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, basically, first of all, to be happy is the number one goal in life.
Mm.
And to be happy then, it's all about how we occupy ourselves and how we put food on the table. Now, you're not going to be very happy if you're starving.
Right.
About 20% of the world at the moment, what have we got, about 7 billion, 8 billion, 7 billion in the world at the moment or something?
Something like that.
They've estimated about 20% of people are starving to death. They're undernourished. And that's a tragedy. And so basically, it's about, first of all, to succeed in life, you need to have food on the table. Now, money became the common factor, how we basically, you work, you get paid money. You want to buy food, you need money to buy food. You want a roof over your head, you need money. And so the principles are, first of all, how we occupy ourselves. Number one, occupy ourselves doing something that gives us joy and satisfaction.
Yes.
And most satisfaction comes actually when you solve a problem, you feel good. And when you help people solve their problems. The funny part about it, when people started to try and make appointments with our company 50 years ago and 40 years ago, the first question I would ask people when they had a meeting with me was, have you looked at how you're going to live your life in retirement? And about 70% of people hadn't really thought of it. They thought, oh, I've got to retire when I'm 65 or 60 years of age, and my superannuation fund hopefully will have enough money to sustain my life. But I haven't really thought about what I'm going to do, Colin. And I said, well, number one, I want you to go home and start thinking about how you're going to live your life. I don't want you to retire until you know how your life is going to evolve.
Mm.
When you figure that out, then make another appointment to come in and see me. Often 6 months later, a year later, I figured it out, Colin. Can I come in and see you? It's about the journey, the path, how we occupy ourselves.
Yes.
And that's where retirement is not a natural thing, Mark. Look, yeah, funny, yeah. Only a couple of days ago I had a phone call from a person down in Wollongong. Colin, my super fund lost quite a bit of money last year. And this person is in her late 40s. Mm-hmm. Said, I won't be able to retire until I'm 80 now, Colin. And I said, well, tell me, how come your fund lost money? Because all the equity funds have had substantial growth in the last 12 months.
Right.
What investment strategies had you taken? Well, she had taken a high risk profile, thinking you'd make a lot of money, but it was the worst time in the world to do what she did, right?
Yeah, right.
And I said, well, look, first of all, don't worry about not being able to have enough money when you retire, because retirement is not natural. And the happiest people are people that get out of bed, they've got something to do. And so the interesting thing, though, if you have got enough money, and of course, what, you know, you realize the Germans were the first ones that introduced retirement in the world.
Is that right?
Yeah. And it was all about the controlling the workforce so that you have work for the younger generation to come through. So the older generation move out of the factory, out of the company.
Mm-hmm.
But the main reason that drove the Germans, that it was for political reasons, they wanted to get rid of certain people. So they created retirement. There was a motive behind it, right? But
sounds on par with my experience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And of course, yeah, a lot of people, look at what this lockdown has done, this virus problems throughout the world. Now, it's not natural to be basically shut up indoors. You know, and again, the path of life, if you don't get the opportunity to learn sporting interests, you know, from our tennis interests in the old days.
Yeah.
Cricket, football, swimming, you know. If you're not in an environment where you learn these basic skills, then it's not part of your life. And our interests originally came through tennis. And then I moved into golf 25 years ago. The fun I have with my golfing friends, we play every Wednesday, we go to lunch, we talk about the problems of the world. And, you know, it's, again, where I'm blessed. Had I never learned anything about agriculture, I wouldn't have bought a farm, Mark, right?
Mm.
But the interesting thing, when I was buying the farm, my father said, son, why are you buying a farm? You know, farms generally don't make much money, you know, and there are a lot of problems, you know. You never know what the markets are going to do. The seasons, we have droughts in this country. We have floods, but we mainly have droughts. Dad, have you ever studied actually basically the average price movement of farm land in rural Australia? No, son. Well, he said, I did an analysis of it. Rural land actually keeps up with inflation and does a little bit better. And every dollar I put into improving the land is a tax deduction for me, Dad. So I'm not paying all my dough in tax. I hadn't thought of it like that, son. But when you're in the bush, it's a 2,000-acre property, and in the bush you're with the birds, the kangaroos. It's just another world, Mark, right? And to have that contrast in life in the city, I'm living in Sydney now, and have the bush, it's another world. It's a more natural world. But farming, you know, it's one of the biggest problems in the world, in that our small farms, everything's migrating to big farms, the family farm declining. The lack of actually farming skills. We've got serious problems in the farming world. And it's interesting. Europe, 25 years ago introduced subsidies for farming because they knew the importance of having food on the table. The average farm was losing money, right?
Yeah.
And like the average farm in Europe is about 50 acres mark, right? The average farm in Australia is about 2,000 acres.
Yeah, that's right.
Bit of a difference, you know, right? But we are blessed in this country, right? But again, the path of life and the philosophy, it's interesting. My father never put a nail in a piece of wood in his life, nor had I.
Mm-hmm.
When my boys, Jamesy and Dave, came along, I thought, now, boys, I want Dave, my oldest, I want you to do 2 years of metalwork at school. And Jamesy, I want you to do 2 years of woodwork. I want you to learn to use your hands just so that you've got that capability of making things. Anyway, okay, Dad, if you wanted to do that. You know, it was amazing, Mark. Years later, Jamesy built the verandas around the farmhouse.
Yeah, right.
And he'd never done those 2 years of woodwork, right? You can't do it, can you? Dave, 2 years of metalwork. Anything ever broke, he did all the welding, fixed everything up, right? Again, the path of life, if we don't learn these little skills, you know nothing about it, you can't go down that path, do you?
Well, I wanted to touch back into the ABC, right? And the A, and as you explained it to me originally, and I certainly took notes as you would support people and advise people, and the A life, as I recall it, and you're alluding to it in so many ways here, but it's when you've got really good health up until a certain age, and that's when you want to be very active. And I remember you distinctly saying, you know, I take a certain amount of holidays every year with my family because this is that time of life and I want to make sure I can afford it. You know, when you hit the B grade, okay, what was B grade age? It was about 60 or 70. Do you remember explaining this to me?
Yeah.
So was that around 60 or 70, you know, you start to slow down a little bit and then you hit your, you know, you hit retirement and then eventually if you live long enough, you've got a C-grade life where you're not that active and you don't need as much loot.
I'm amazed that you can remember this conversation. Because
I took notes. Because that's how you were advising people. I took it in. I still haven't got it right because I basically have acted retired since I was young. And it's funny you're talking about woodwork and metalwork because I took both courses and I took art and I've never done anything with it ever and I don't plan to. I can tell you that right now. I'd much prefer to hire someone to do that, do those things.
But yeah. Well, again,
I've learnt the LA way. How's that?
Well, the funny part about, again, how it evolves is that dealing with all these people, like we had a period of time in the early 80s, we had massive depression in Australia and people near retirement effectively being forced to retire. Mm. But again, dealing with people and about their life all the time, I realised I did an analysis as to basically the health experience of most people.
Mm.
And what I discovered, exactly what up till age 60, most people have almost A-grade health up to age 70.
Mm.
70 to 80, most of us move to a B-grade category. You know, and all our joints in our body are starting to fail, right? Cancer might be occurring, right? But then from 80, majority of us move to a C-grade category. Health declines even more rapidly.
Yes.
And so that when I did this analysis, I then wrote a letter to all our clients advising them about basically this research that I had undertaken because people, and what drove it? Nobody knows how long they're going to live for. And so because of that unknown factor, the number they don't know how to spend their money. I might need it when I'm 90 years of age.
Right.
When I pointed out to them basically the historical experience of health, what it said was up till 70, see the world, climb Mount Everest, have fun.
Yes.
70 to 80, you won't quite have the same energy, but you'll still be active. And over 80, right, you're probably going to be spending more time at home, looking after each other, right, and reading books and relying upon entertainment, right?
Yes.
So what that said to them, okay, don't be frightened. And I even worked a formula. Like the average client going back 20, 30 years ago when they retired, they had 300,000 in their total investment funds. On average, they had a cost of living of 35,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then they looked at spending 10 to at least 10,000 a year on travel. So they needed 45,000 a year. Now, we're aiming at earning an average of 8% a year, which is only 25,000. But in Australia, they were picking up also about 15,000 an age pension.
Right.
So they had pretty close to 40,000 a year cash flow. But because of the study, the analysis of our health, the goal was you can spend your capital, but you had to at least have 100,000 never spent when you get to 80.
Yeah, okay.
Left over? Because the age pension then went up higher to 35,000. You needed less money, you're not traveling, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that whole thinking, I'm amazed that you remember this, was driven about how to spend your money.
Well, I wanted to take a deeper dive into this too. And certainly you've educated me in so many facets of the financial world, but you know, life itself. And I've loved our conversations my whole life. But for young people in particular, but even for any age, I'd like you to talk about where do you go these days for financial literacy? You know, I find that it's still not taught in the school system. It's only really people who get into finance that ever are really educated about the depths of it all, because it really is, you've got to take that thing head on and take it. It's such a big beast to put your arms around. And then as you've discussed, and this is coming back to our virtues around who do you trust and honesty in these environments, you know. So I'd like you to touch into what you would recommend a person who would like to educate themselves more around financial literacy and how to take care of their financial life.
Okay, well, it's not really that difficult, you know. But 99% of people have never had any formal training in investment management.
Hmm.
Right? Now, so the interesting thing, everything's basically driven by one principle. It's called supply and demand, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The economics, right? And I can remember when Jamesy was living out in far west of middle of Australia, and he said, "Dad, I think I'd like to buy a home out here."
Literally the back of Bourke.
Yes.
which Australians will understand for the rest of our listeners, it is in the middle of nowhere of Australia.
I said, "That's... not a bad idea, Jamesy. Are you going to live there forever?" "Well, probably not, Dad, right?" He was a teacher, right?
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Well, James, the only problem is that places like our country towns like Bourke, their actual populations are actually declining. So housing actually becomes an oversupply. Your money won't keep up with inflation. It would be better, as in, from an investment perspective, just rent a place, but buy a home on the coast of Australia, New South Wales, where demand is growing and it will keep up with inflation." So the first place he bought was a house on the south coast of New South Wales, right? Anyway, he fell in love with a Dutch girl, as we know, Bedina.
Yep.
They get married, children, and they want to buy a home again. They're still in Bourke, aren't they? I said, "That's okay, Jamesy. Buy the house, right?" Anyway, they were there for 10 years.
Yeah.
And then Jamesy moved to Armidale, right?
Yep.
You know, this was 3 years ago now, they still haven't been able to sell their Burke home mark.
Is that right, huh?
Right.
Can they
but
rent
because
it?
He had the home on the South Coast, he was able to sell that. And with the profits, they're able to buy their new home. He's got a 50-acre farm, I think it is, in Armidale.
Mm-hmm.
But had he not had the property on the South Coast, he would never have been able to buy the new home he's got.
Yeah,
now, he's renting the home in Burksville.
Right.
But it's all about basically supply and demand.
Mm-hmm.
It's the number one principle you learn in life, right?
Yes.
But the other thing is everything is so fragile, Mark. Nothing's permanent, right?
Well, it's even more so right now, I think.
Look at the world today and how artificial everything is, right?
Yes.
Because of the virus problem, then the lockdown, the problems with our hospital system, but people, the whole lifestyle was changed.
Yes.
And the government, people losing income, how do they pay the rent on the repayments on their home? So what do the government do artificially? They reduce interest rates, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
So people can hopefully maintain at least ownership of their home with interest rates low. Now, what the low interest rates did, those people that are still working could get out and buy a property and driven housing values higher than ever, haven't they?
Yeah, it certainly has, particularly where I'm living right here.
It's all artificial, Mark, right?
Yeah.
Now, the irony of a tragedy for older people, when people retire, they want security, number one.
Yes.
They want consistency in return. And the average retiree needs a return of 7-8% a year. Now, the problem is, because everything is so artificial, if you don't understand how it all works, right, you can actually make some terrible decisions. You can lose a lot of money, retirees in particular, throughout the whole world because of conservative strategies. 70% of their money is mainly in fixed interest securities,
yes,
government bonds and things.
Yes,
most of them are earning less than 1% on their money at the moment.
Amazing.
Yet the stock market has taken off. And now when interest rates go up, all this artificial spending by the governments to keep everything moving, because you've got to keep people working, right?
Yeah.
And but effectively, we've probably got an overvalued equity market, an overvalued housing market. It is so fragile. And I suppose the other important thing from all this is why we shouldn't take life too seriously, Mark. It's so out of our control. You know what I mean?
It really is.
And it's about being sensible. Own the roof over your head, number one.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, if somebody else owns it, you never know when they're going to ask you to move on. They want to sell it, get out, right? Own the roof over your head. Try to pursue a career path that gives you pleasure. It's not just all about money. But, you know, one of my best friends, he retired 10 years ago as a dentist, but he was just one of my mates from school days.
Mm-hmm.
He went through his whole career and never enjoyed what he did. He was interested in computer technology.
Mm.
So he did a bit of study, but he couldn't get a job in it. He couldn't earn the money that he was earning from his dentistry, right?
Right.
So he stayed with his dentistry. And so his decision was based, okay, I make good money here. I can look after my family. We've got money to have a good life. But the tragedy was he wasn't getting joy from his work. Within 1 year of his retirement, he was diagnosed with cancer. And for 10 years now, it's chemo.
Mm.
He's got a terrible life. And when he was at university, he played golf off a handicap of 5, Mark. He was so good, right? Good. But he was one of my closest friends at school, and we remained friends all our lives. But the tragedy is his work never gave him joy. And he reflects on the mistakes he made. times when he realised he did the wrong thing by some of his clients and patients. But look, the roller coaster is that there's no certainty in anything. You've got to have that adaptability. But I think at the end of the day, our communication with each other, it's an area where I think the human race is failing. We're not as open as we should with each other.
Mm.
I think probably the problem with business, the driver of politics, you know, the big business, money to the political parties, the level of dishonesty, it's all about money. And this is where, unless the world embraces honesty, there's no future for the human race, in my opinion, Mark. Mm. It's so serious. And the level of fraudulent behaviour in our business world, it's frightening. People's lives are being destroyed because of fraud, theft. And the governments, look at our accounting system, our audit system. It actually doesn't detect fraud, Mark.
Right.
Oh, my God. You know, we think auditors sign off as true and fair. There's been no truth and nothing fair. They actually don't look for fraud. Auditors, we should have the confidence in financial reporting that it's been done properly. That's why we need auditors. They're not doing the job properly, Mark. Our regulators, simply, there's been a cover-up throughout the world of the fraudulent behaviour, the misconduct in financial reporting and business. It's a cover-up going on throughout the whole world for the last 20 to 30 years, Mark.
Well, you certainly could be a professor on it at this point. I mean, you've had to walk through it like I know and no one else, and I certainly got to taste it, but certainly you've had to walk through it, and it's something you've become a true warrior about as to how we go about that. I think that's probably prompted me, Cole, on doing these podcasts. I mean, one thing that prompted me is I am in Ojai, and due to lockdown, how do I communicate with people and share with my friends? And this is a way that I've gone about that. But I did make it about exploring life's virtues and what do we care about, because it is, I have seen, and through your eyes and through those experiences, and then I've got other ones that have existed after that, just how greed is destroying so much of the wonderful things that are in life. I don't want to say life is in itself, but we're flipping it back in its head where it becomes more into a dictation or how the monarchs were, rather than a true democracy where there is fair and justness. I don't have all the answers on this, but I certainly have got an approach, which is what you originally started with is how do we serve one another? How do we care about one another, regardless of if we got anything back or not? That opens a doorway into abundance, you know, because we can move into the barter system if need be. We can move into all these things that people feel good about. But I want to end our podcast, one on who do you think's ahead in golf, you or me? Because I don't know who's extracted the more joy out of the game, but certainly we've had a lot of fun on the golf course all around the world, Cole, and having a punt and having a laugh. But the way that we've gone about our golfing is having a lot of fun. It's if we have a punt, it's for a beer or a sandwich or something like that. The stakes are very, very high in pride. You know, but you've been very good at changing the rules along the way. So I've learned a thing or two from you in that, how to adjust the rules when they're not in your favour. Yeah. What would you like? We're just finishing on time here. What would you like our listeners here with?
Well, the irony of it, it's not difficult to sort out these major misconduct and fraudulent behaviour problems, Mark. It's simply the penalties applied to people that have been involved with, found to have been fraudulent, dishonest, the penalties are simply all too low. If you have a penalty system that people realise, if I get discovered doing this dishonest behaviour, I'll go to jail for a minimal 10 years, we might just stop that type of behaviour.
And even so, there's got to be something beyond that too, right? Like just to jail someone is, okay, you're taking away their freedoms and their liberties. But I think there's a re-education that needs to take place of people who are this way inclined, you know, because I see people who come back out of jail and they're back onto their schemes again, you know.
Yeah, well, that's the worst part about it. Apparently about 70% of people that commit crime after jail, they recommit, Mark, right? Mm-hmm. But again, I think our penalty system is too inadequate. Yes. That's the first thing that's got to be tidied up. And I'm trying to influence our government at the moment on basically setting up proper compensation schemes for people that lose all their money through fraudulent behaviour. An audit system that has just got to be fixed up, our penalty systems. We've got to stop this type of behaviour. And
I will say something there, Cole. And you know, I was raised in Australia, but Australia versus the rest of the world is very fair and just. I mean, one of the things that I learned with the superannuation funds when all that stuff that we're involved with went down, not any cause of ours, but just the nature of fraud that happened, you know, there was an insurance of what I think it was 1% of all superannuation funds, if I recall. That doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. So there is some type of checks and balances that I think Australia has tried to make versus the rest of the world. But still, it is rampant. It is everywhere. And you know, I guess I hate to say it, but, you know, the first world is probably organized corruption at its finest, and the third world is a more obvious corruption, you know, but and that's part of the human race, I guess we can say, but I guess we make our contribution through supporting people as best we can and regardless of the conditions, you know, but you've been a fighter for a greater cause, I know that.
Well, I think we're all here for a purpose, aren't we? And until I sort these problems out, I got to hang around, Mark, right?
Or until I get back and we have another game of golf. So,
well, Mark, it's just been so nice to sort of have this chat with you. And it's a real pleasure. Just give us a bell whenever you want to do it again.
All right, Cole. I bid you farewell, and thanks for this yarn.
Thank you, Mark. Catch.